I'm going to talk about a particular electrical Foucault's, but I want to situate it first quickly in the context of what I'm trying to do. I'm writing a book on Foucault at the moment, which is under the title of Foucault's Last Decade, which is an attempt to try to use the lecture courses, other previously unpublished materials, some of the stuff that's in archives in Paris that you can get access to, and so basically the entirety of Foucault's work, to try to trace what he was doing in that last decade, and particularly why the history of sexuality, which was initially planned as a thematic treatment, ended up being effectively abandoned and then being reworked into the more properly historical treatment he was working on at the point that he died, and to use the lecture courses to try to reconstruct what we know about what Foucault originally intended, to venture some suggestions on why he abandoned that initial version and then why it mutated into the version he was working on at his death. And the thing I'm going to talk about today comes from the first chapter. There's a couple of opening chapters where I talk about Foucault from kind of 1969 to 1974 or so as a kind of background to the work of the last decade. The reason the last decade came about is that we know that Foucault, I can't quite believe this is true, but the indications are that Foucault finished work on Discipline and Punish, and on that very same day began work on The History of Sexuality, Volume 1, which was on the 28th of August, 1974, which is almost exactly 10 years before he died, which is 25th of June, 1984. So that last decade is the entirety of the History of Sexuality project, but there's traces of the History of Sexuality project that go further back. So the thing that I've given you as a handout tries to reconstruct what we know about how we see the lecture courses lining up with what Foucault intended to do with the History of Sexuality project. So that the only volume of the History of Sexuality actually published out of the original plan was the introduction, The Will to Know or The Will to Knowledge. And then he plans these five subsequent volumes to follow from it, but none of those ever appeared. We know from various indications that he had draft manuscripts of at least two of those volumes, which we're told have been completely destroyed. I don't think those are in the archive. But he used them on the basis of some of the lecture courses. Some of them developed from some of these early lecture courses and others are used as the basis for the delivery of those lectures. So we can use the lectures, I think, to reconstruct something of what Foucault was trying to do at that time. And then Foucault went through various plans too that I've indicated here, where he has a very long manuscript which comprises material that ends up being in the second and third volume of The History of Sexuality, but were originally intended to be part of a single book. And then the title, The Care of the Self, was initially intended to be on completely different material to what's in the actual book called The Care of the Self, which takes material from the old Use of Pleasures when it splits into two. And so there's a whole set of complicated versions of it. It's not simply there was one plan and another plan. There are various indications in interviews and so on where Foucault talks about some of these different plans. But the point of this is to give you some sense of how these lectures line up and so on. Now, that number sequence seems to make no sense, except for the fact that that's the order that they've published the lecture courses. It's been really difficult, given they've done this not quite randomly, but kind of all over the place, moving from mid-period courses to late courses, back to early courses and so on, to do the kind of work I'm trying to do of this reconstruction of where Foucault was at, how things transformed over time, how concepts emerged in his work, how they might have been called different things at different points and so on. But now there's only two courses unpublished, the second and the tenth. I think you can see a lot more of that kind of chronology of what he's working on. And what I'm going to talk about today is the third of these courses. It's the most recently published in French. It's not out in English, although the translation is being worked on at the moment. It should be out probably sometime next year. So, what Foucault does in that course is to try to think through a whole range of historical and political questions. The course originally had the title of The Disciplinary Society, and that's a description that Foucault later uses of its analyses. It's a course that is very important for subsequent works, but not simply the book Discipline and Punish, which came out a couple of years later, but Foucault uses the analyses of this course in relation to some of his later courses. So in the Abnormals lecture course, for example, he provides a brief overview of the transition that he's trying to trace in that course and refers back to this course rather than to the book, which is about to come out. It's kind of strange that he doesn't say, you know, you'll find more detail on this in the book that's coming out next week. He refers back to a previous lecture course. And I think it is an obvious way to read this course as a kind of a first draft of Discipline and Punish, but there's some complications in reading it that way. Foucault gave these lectures between January and March 1973 and completed a draft of Discipline and Punish in April 1973, but he didn't complete the final version until August 1974, and then it was published in February 1975. And if we're looking for those kind of early traces, we can find a number of indications. So we find a discussion, for example, of Bentham, Beccaria and Colquhoun, the regicide Damiens, who's very famous from that opening scene of Discipline and Punish. He appears in this course. The prison is extremely important. So there's a number of elements in the book that are trialled out here. But equally, there's a number of themes in Discipline and Punish that aren't discussed here. And the indications from the other lecture courses is that Foucault tried out a lot of material in the Psychiatric Power course, and particularly in the Truth and Juridical Forms lectures he gave in Rio in May 1973, which replicates some of the material from this course, but also adds some new material. So what I'm going to try and do today is not just focus on the parts of the book that parts of the course that anticipate the book, but also the other things that are going on in this course. And it's long been known that Foucault's work with the Group for Information on Prisons, a kind of a pressure group that Foucault was involved in setting up in the early 1970s, was important in terms of what he does in Discipline and Punish. There's that famous phrase in Discipline and Punish where he says, "I'm not interested in writing history in the terms of the past, but I'm interested in writing history in the terms of the present. I'm trying to write the history of the present, in a sense." And that group, which he's been trying to do work on information on the French penal system at the time he's writing, is important, but this course is more proximate to it in terms of temporality. The group had been disbanded just before this course was delivered. So five themes that I want to try and talk about that come out of that book for me, and I'll work through those in sequence. So the first one of these on measure, inquiry and examination. Now Foucault's giving this as his third College de France lecture, and many of the people that would have been in his audience would have been in the previous two. And it's especially important to see it as a third part of this three lecture course chronology, because he makes a relation between something he'd analysed in the first course, Lectures on the Will to Know, which we now have in English translation, where he talks about the concept of measure, relates it to the question of the inquiry, which was a focus of the as yet unpublished Penal Theories and Institutions, his second course at the college. And then in this course, the emergence of the category of the examination. Now, the examination takes on a significant role in Discipline and Punish and some of Foucault's later courses. But here, the description of it is that the examination is the permanent control of individuals, like a permanent test or an ordeal, without a final point. It's an inquiry, but it's one that takes place before any offence, outside of any crime. It's an inquiry of a general and a priori suspicion of the individual. We can name as examination this uninterrupted, graduated, accumulated proof which permits a control and continuous pressure to follow the individual in each of their steps to see if they are regular or irregular, stored or dissipated, normal or abnormal. The examination making this perpetual partition authorises a gradual distribution of individuals up to the judicial limit. Now, that's of course very close to how we are commonly understand what Foucault's talking about with discipline, with normalisation, and so on. But the following sentence in the lecture course links it to a political economy that's usually much more muted in Foucault's work. Thus, he says, we can see born at the precise point of the relation of the body of the labourer to the forces of production, a form of knowledge which is that of the examination. So that's where the examination situates itself in terms of the kind of political economy or a Marxism, and that's a central theme of this course, and I'll say quite a bit more about that as I go on. The second theme is of modes of punishment, and he begins the course with a kind of somewhat playful allusion to the idea that we can distinguish societies on the basis of how they treat the dead, whether they bury them or whether they cremate them. And he wonders whether we can use this to think about societies more generally. How do they treat problematic living people? Do they use mechanisms of exclusion or inclusion? And then he goes on and says, well, exclusion's a problematic term, so is the notion of transgression. And if we need to use these, we need to think about them within a broadly or broader or differently conceived model, where he says there's no longer the question of law, of the rule, of representation, but of power rather than law, of knowledge rather than representation. Now, what he tries to do in this course is to say that there have been four key ways that society has dealt with problematic people in the past, four tactics he calls of sanction or of punishment. And he wants to map out four different ways that they've punished in the past. First one is the notion of exclusion. Second, of making atonement or imposing a compensation. The third one is marking or branding. And the fourth one is in prison. Now, the four of them are presented in different ways by Foucault at different times. But it's important that the first two are so crucial to the analysis he's trying to make here. There's a traditional way of reading discipline and punish as if it's proposing simply a move from what effectively is the third, the physical exercise of power on the individual body of somebody who's been condemned of a crime, to punishment. How do we make that move from one to the other? Foucault here is trying to stress that the notion of exclusion is a past punishment, and he makes a reference back to exclusion or banishment within ancient Greece, something that he'd spent some time in the first lecture course discussing, but also goes on to look at how the idea of atonement or compensation was a major feature of medieval Germanic law. And it's clear from the course that he spent some time in the previous course talking about that particular question. We know from all the indications that Foucault spends most of the previous year's course on the medieval and the early modern period in looking at these questions. But it is the third and the fourth that become the key focus of this course, even if the other courses had looked at the first two. And he talks about a whole range of ways that bodies are marked by the exercise of power, with an emphasis on what he calls the sign, i.e. the wider social value that this has, that they mark these bodies not simply for what it does to that body, but for the sign it gives out to people as a whole. And that these can be in a variety of ways. The hands of thieves are cut off, for example, but it's about making this as a visible sign, especially making power the visible power of the sovereign. He says the tactic of branding, which is preponderant in the West from the end of the High Middle Ages until the 18th century, is captured by this notion. Now, in Discipline and Punish, Foucault uses the word supplice to talk about this. Supplice is a particular form of torture that's a very physical and very public form of torture. It's a type of torture that is shown to the crowd. But in this course, that term only appears once. It's underplayed, although I suspect that it was a major focus of the previous year's course. Here he talks simply about there was such a lavish variety, a sumptuous variety of supplice, because this form of punishment was calibrated to a whole series of variables: who committed the crime, what acts they committed, and of the victim. So he says there's the stake for heresy, quartering for traitors, the cropping of ears for thieves, pierced tongues for blasphemers, and so on. Now, he talks about the death penalty here, and he mentions Damian's the regicide and what happened to him. But he says, even though today, at the point Foucault's writing, 1973, even though today in France the death penalty continues, the death penalty today is not the same as the death penalty of previous eras. The death penalty in France was only abolished in 1981. He says what we have today in the death penalty is effectively an extreme form of imprisonment, because it is not the visible display of the marks of power on a human body. So it's imprisonment that he's interested in looking at as the tactic, he says, that becomes prevalent today and that became established at the turn of the 19th century. So that's, in a sense, the historical problem of the course. And he talks about there's a number of different varieties of punishment in the past, but what we've ended up with is a form of punishment that only basically has one form, which is that of imprisonment. He says you have all of these different ways of punishing in the past, both in order to achieve social goals, to show the exemplary nature of prison, to show this to the public, of punishment to dissuade, and so on, and that infamy, compensation or amendment, slavery, and so on, have different forms of tactic that are going on in order to address the aim that they have. But he says in prison, an abstract, monotonous, rigid, punitive system, the only graduated variable is time, how long the punishment is actually for. And he says there's an economic parallel here. Everyone is given a salary for labour time, and inversely, time at liberty is taken as the price for violation. Time is the only property possessed. It is bought for work or it is taken for violation. So he says that the imprisonment and wage labour are historical twins. And he says, I'm not suggesting here there's a causal relation between them, that the socio-economic directly changes penal practice, but he says it's striking that the system of capitalist power and the system of punishment in the prison both show time exchange against power. How striking it is that imprisonment parallels the organisation of worker time in the factory and the distribution and calculation of time in salary, the control of leisure, the life of the worker, savings, retirement, etc. This is what he calls the global hold of power over time. That the sole tenet of punitive regimes is over the offences and the disciplinary regime of labour. It's the relation of lifetime to political power. It's repression of time and by time. It's this species continuity between the factory clock, the chronometry of the chain gang, and the prison calendar. Now, the relation, of course, to Marx could be made here, although this isn't the same as the labour theory of value. You might describe it as something like the time theory of labour and punishment, something along those lines. It's the parallel that he's interested in tracing here. The third of the themes that I want to say something about is the idea of the civil war and the social enemy. Now, the army is a key theme in Discipline and Punish, and actually I think it's probably the true model of the disciplinary society in that text. In a sense, the prison is the thing that needs to be explained. The army is one of the ways that Foucault uses to try to explain how the prison came about, of the mechanisms taken from the military into the punitive or disciplinary society more generally. Now, the army is discussed a little bit in this text, but what's striking, or striking for me at least, was the very lengthy discussion of civil war in a way that anticipates Foucault's 1976 course, Society Must Be Defended, but falls out of the way in how Discipline and Punish itself gets put together. Foucault suggests we need to think about these tactics of penalty or imprisonment within a wider understanding of power, asking what forms of power were there that led to these tactics of exclusion, branding, compensation, and imprisonment. And the analysis of the tactics is in order to shed light on power, not on juridical representations, morals, or ideology. He says he wants to examine struggle, conflicts, and political protests within this notion of power, which can be conceived within the frame of civil war. Now, he obviously has to account for Hobbes and Rousseau here, but he says in their work, the idea that civil war is something that continues past the moment of the contract is not really considered. Civil war is seen as something that existed before the social contract and is really natural rather than civil in that focus. He says, from the contract onwards, civil war is only the monstrous prolongation of the war of all against all in a social structure which must normally be controlled by the contract. For Hobbes and Rousseau, civil war is the accident, the anomaly, something that must be avoided. Foucault says, actually, we need to think about it in a slightly different way. Civil war is the permanent state, and this allows us to understand a number of tactics of struggle, of which penalty is the privileged example. Civil war is the matrix of all struggles for power, all strategies of power, and as a consequence, also the matrix for all struggles concerning and against power. So he stresses that there is a universal and constant war within society, and that the penal system is not equally applied to everyone, but operates in the interests of some against others. And this is the crucial thing in the structure of universal and constant surveillance and the system of imprisonment. So he says the civil war he's talking about is not the same as Hobbes' war of all against all, but it is rather the war of the rich against the poor, the propertied against those who possess nothing, the masters or the employers against the proletariat. And he does discuss Hobbes, and especially Hobbes' argument of the Leviathan and the emergence of a sovereign figure, but he wants to reject a number of the claims that Hobbes makes, especially this idea in Hobbes that the war precedes the establishment of power or is exterior to power. For Foucault, it's precisely a struggle of power. And Foucault spends a little bit of time talking about some examples of collective movements, of struggles against the dominant power at the time. So he talks about market riots of peasants in Normandy. He talks about the revolution of the bare feet, the nu-pieds in France in the 17th century, and of machine breakers, the Luddites in England. And the indications from the editorial apparatus is that he spent quite a bit more time talking about those in the previous year's course. There's an indication that the revolution of the bare feet is treated in six lectures of the previous course, which is extraordinary if that's the case. That would be Foucault's most extensive treatment, I think, of a kind of a, what we might call resistance to power, if that's actually the case in that course. So politics is then for Foucault conceived as the continuation of civil war. this civil war is not a war of all against all, a Hobbesian war, but it's serving specific purposes. And what's interesting in this course is there's a very clear indication that Foucault understands what the purpose of discipline and incarceration actually is, of whose interests it serves. And if you read Discipline and Punish alone, that's harder to see in terms of that. Henri Lefebvre, among others, criticised Foucault for precisely that point of saying, you know, whose interest is discipline and punishment actually for? Who's actually trying to benefit from these kinds of mechanisms? What's interesting in relation to Foucault's other works is why that disappears and why that isn't so stressed in Discipline and Punish, given that Foucault's made this argument with these kind of indications elsewhere. What's also interesting is why do Hobbes and Clausewitz, who are so important in this course, why do they disappear from Discipline and Punish only to re-emerge in the 1976 course, Society Must Be Defended? So it does give us that possibility of rereading Discipline and Punish in the light of this course, but also in terms of what happens in Society Must Be Defended, of looking at the advent of the disciplinary or punitive society as one of these strategies between this in this wider civil, or we might even say a class war. Although it's not really a simple class war, Foucault's talking about the way that these tactics are directed against what he calls the social enemy. It might be the criminal, but it might be in later courses the perverse, the insane, others that don't fit the mould, or even in Society Must Be Defended, the war of one race against another race. But the direction of the course here is towards the end of better productive relations. It's about what purposes these might serve in order to transform the way that society is going, or whose class interests are important in this. So he talks about the criminal as a social or a public enemy. We could even almost say the enemy within a society. And juridical practice is a declaration of public war against that figure. He talks about the way that the jury cannot really be understood as a jury of somebody's peers, but the jury is representatives of the society that is trying to punish that social enemy. So that society, in the name of its representatives, makes the decision on somebody. He looks at the effect of privileged knowledges or sciences, the notion of savoir, such as psychopathology and criminal or deviant psychiatry in this work. And he talks about the problem of the connaissance of a prisoner, the knowledge of the individual instance of a prisoner, as becoming part of the object of these scientific modes of criminology towards them. He says the institution therefore opens up an entire field of possible knowledge, a parallel with the hospital. What the hospital is for the body, he says, the prison is for the soul. So we get the idea of the criminal as a particular figure. And he says, I would like to undertake a critical analysis of the sociologization of the criminal as a social enemy, sociologization which affects currently controlled penal practice, psychopathology of delinquency, and the sociology of criminality. So this social enemy is a major theme in the course. He talks about various examples, a 1789 proclamation of the National Constituent Assembly, so just after the French Revolution, which describes an offence committed as one where society as a whole is injured by one of its members. He talks about the physiocrat Guillaume de Troisnet's memoir on vagabonds and beggars, we might call it, the mendiant. That's a text that is discussed in Discipline and Punish, but is discussed in more detail here, where he says there's been a shift from earlier things like begging or idleness to the idea of vagabondage, which is a matrix of crime and delinquency, a scourge is his word for the economy, somebody who disrupts production because they are fundamentally somebody who does not work, who refuses labour. And one of the discussions touches on the use of a worker's booklet. I'm not sure booklet's quite the right word, but it's about a document that workers had to take with them. That was a contractual document between the employer, the boss, and the worker, but also a police measure, and that there is therefore an economic and a moral control over the worker. He says the booklet is one of the institutions which are not exactly penal, but make it possible to ensure the continuity of the punitive and the penal. Another indication is of the debate about the death penalty in revolutionary France. But the most striking, perhaps, is when Foucault references Marx's articles on the theft of wood. These are 1840s articles that Marx wrote for one of the German newspapers. And he says what's interesting here is about the way that the right to gather wood is curtailed as landowners become more and more interested in asserting their absolute right to their landed property. You can't just gather wood and use it for firewood yourselves, but the landowners are claiming an exclusive right to property and exclusive right to property with everything that's in that area as well. The fourth thing I want to say something about is how Foucault uses England as an example as much as France here. There's a footnote in Discipline and Punish where Foucault says his investigation is going to be in relation to France and that a comparative analysis would be too burdensome and any analysis as a whole too schematic. But in this course, there's a very lengthy discussion of England as a counterpoint to France. He's interested in this shift from earlier forms of punishment to a new punitive tactic of imprisonment, and he finds this emerge in England and France around the same time, around 1790. And he notes that imprisonment was perhaps surprisingly not a major thing within previous punitive systems. He says that prisons existed, but they were not situated within a general punitive system. A striking issue, he says, that discourses on punishment did not initially work within the prison. The prison was seen as a lawless place. Prisons were places that existed, but they weren't there for punishment. They were there to guard somebody or to guarantee somebody. So you might imprison a political prisoner, a political enemy, or you might imprison a debtor to ensure that you got the debt paid back to you. But this changes around 1790, he suggests, in both England and France, where it becomes this part of this mode of social defence, of social production. So he says, I'm going to take two landmarks, England and France, to study the conditions of acceptability which made possible the generalisation of the prison form and the penitentiary domain in the 18th century. And in terms of England, he's interested in a whole range of religious dissenters and how they understood how society needed to be transformed. So he talks about the Quakers and the Methodists. He talks about societies for the reform of morals. He talks about societies for the suppression of vice in order to get people to respect Sunday, to close gambling houses and brothels, to prevent indecent literature, and so on. He talks about the constitution of self-defence or society defence groups of a semi-paramilitary nature, which demonstrates the importance of their economic function. They're there to protect property. They're there to protect bourgeois fortune. This could be in shops, workshops, docks, trade routes, and so on, that these kinds of groups start to be constituted. And he says this last theme is situated within a much wider range of economic transformations, of population movements, new uses of capital, the division of labour, the circulation of merchandise. As the capitalist mode of production develops, he says, capital finds itself exposed to a certain number of risks that need to be more controllable than before. Capital is exposed, in effect, not only to theft or pillage as before, but to the problems of those people that are actually the labour force within it. If these people are not doing the right kinds of things, we need to transform this because it's going to damage the threat it's going to provide a threat to property. The political regime in England, he says, did not provide sufficient guarantees for the bourgeoisie, and so, because of a weakness of centralised power, there is a micro-territoriality of judicial bodies and penal instruments, and on the other hand, a penal code of extreme rigour. This had been set up by the Crown, but was inadequate to the new situation, so the bourgeoisie lobbied for a more exacting penal code in order to protect and support these kind of things. The new system of control, he says, that emerges is on the limits of morality and punishment. Its aim is not so much for the detection and punishing of crime, but rather to address its conditions, to instill norms of behaviour, moralising and controlling the lower classes. Its aims were patience, work, sobriety, frugality, religion. It's a passage he takes from Edmund Burke's Thoughts and Details on Scarcity. Now, Foucault says that some of the most important theorists of penal right at this time, like Bentham and Beccaria, were trying to look not simply at punishing what had happened, but trying to direct the moral conduct of people in the first instance. They were concerned with the utility of society, but also there's a moralisation and a movement of state power towards these moral goals on behalf of the higher classes. The state is seen to be required, he says, to become an instrument of moralisation of those classes. And the central figure that he focuses on here is Patrick Colquhoun, and particularly the police of the metropolis, where he says, it's unfortunate when we teach morals, when we undertake a history of morals, we always explicate the foundations of the metaphysics of morals by Kant. and we don't teach or read Colquhoun, who is actually more fundamental to our morality. The Panopticon only appears very briefly in this text. It's mentioned once, it appears in some notes that Foucault prepared but didn't read, and again in the course summary, although Bentham is a much more important figure here. He does, Foucault in this course, stress the Panopticon is a form of power but also a form of knowledge gathering, and the neologism panopticism appears but only in some notes that weren't delivered at the time of this course. What's interesting though is that when Foucault discusses the spatial form of the prism, in this course his relation is to the star design, the idea of a prism where you have these long corridors from a centralised point and that you can walk up and down those corridors in order to survey the people that are in the cells. But Foucault hasn't yet made the big claim about the Panopticon that he does in Discipline and Punish. But a key thing that he keeps stressing here is why this system is being constituted in the first place, and towards the question of wealth. Towards the end of the 18th century, he says it's increasingly merchants and aristocrats, people linked to power, that promote this form of control and crucially decide who it is targeted against. It's not so much, he says, as the transition from the marginal or irregular individuals in themselves, but towards a wider class of workers, one social class dominating another. The state, he says, as the agent or essential support for the moralisation of the poor classes. In France, things are slightly different from this, and it's perhaps not surprising that Foucault effectively abandons this comparative analysis when he produces the book Discipline and Punish. And yet, he retains many of the texts and thinkers from England that he's used to illustrate the claims of England. Foucault claims in France it's not so much a bourgeois revolution as in England, but it's a monarchy that initially puts these things into practice because it's dealing with specific problems of control. It has these a police apparatus directly in the hands of the king and then taken over by the lieutenants of the police. But here, as elsewhere, he's most interested in how the social utilisation of power is at what he calls the capillary level, and gives an example of the lettres de cachet as an example of this. The lettres de cachet is something that Foucault was interested in from as far back as the History of Madness, and at various points in his career he keeps talking about the idea of producing a collection of these texts. They only were finally published as a book co-compiled and authored with the historian Aleph Fage in 1982. Lettres de cachet were letters that bore the seal of the king that allowed somebody to be imprisoned for an indefinite period. Now Foucault says, yes, we could look at this in terms of the king as a symbol of an autocratic arbitrary power, but he says what's interesting about them is not who signs the letters but who requests the letters. So it's not just that they bear the hand of the king, but it's the kinds of people that ask for them. And the kinds of people that do this are they use this to imprison troublesome relatives or people that they have disputes with or people that they just want out of the way. Individuals, he says, request these: families, religious groups, esteemed citizens, legal persons, corporations. So it's not just then the expression of state power or the king's power in them, but a circular process between people, more lowly administrators and so on, in the workings of power. He calls this an example of localised micro-powers. And out of all of the figures, out of these stories, he suggests it would be possible to constitute a kind of perpetual biography of infamy, a sort of anti-Plutarch. Plutarch is the person who wrote the parallel lives of great Greek and Roman figures. But he calls this, instead of the lives of famous figures, the lives of infamous men. And what's interesting, it seems to me, about this is that here in the early 1970s, Foucault is thinking about all of these kinds of individuals and the strange stories of these individuals, which you see come through in the psychiatric power lecture course, you see come through particularly in the abnormals lecture course, but these figures almost entirely disappear from Discipline and Punish. Discipline and Punish has very few individuals mentioned, other than Damiens at the beginning and the theorists that Foucault is discussing. But everything else is this kind of anonymised form of power, both anonymised in terms of who's exercising the power, but who the figures that power is exercised on. And yet, Foucault is collecting all of this material through the early part of the 70s, through into the mid-1970s, and that he had intended to use these kinds of figures precisely in order to illustrate the points he wants to make in the History of Sexuality, the subsequent volumes of the History of Sexuality. He produced extensive dossiers on the perverse, on hermaphrodites, on hysterical women, various other figures that he wants to address in the History of Sexuality, and he's already doing that work back in the early 1970s. Now, that rough sketch of what Foucault's trying to do here with England and France as the two examples perhaps makes some sense of why Discipline and Punish, as I said, concentrates largely on French examples but still has traces of the English theorists, the Bentham, the Beccaria, the Colquhoun and so on, that Foucault had used in this course to trace more specifically English debates and theorists. Key elements in the story here, such as the Quakers and the English dissidents, are only present in a very minor role in Discipline and Punish. And it seems to me that this course makes more explicit what Foucault calls the genealogy of modern morals, or the genealogy of morality that he's tracing. That this course, it seems to me, matches that description much better than Discipline and Punish does, because of the focus on the kinds of figures that he's looking at here. The last of the kind of themes that I want to say something about is on political economy. A lot of what I've said has suggested how important the political economic is to Foucault's analysis in this course. And he's situating his argument quite explicitly within a wider set of historical transitions from feudalism to capitalism. So in that relation of morality to economy, we might read him, Bernard Arcour, the editor of the course, suggests we can read him in relation both to Marx, but also in relation to Weber, the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism. And Harcourt makes an explicit point that should be obvious, but is often neglected, that the Marxist theory of the accumulation of capital is, for Foucault, dependent on disciplinary techniques, which are themselves intimately linked to capitalist production techniques, in order to produce productive bodies, docile bodies. Now, Discipline and Punish obviously has a discussion of political economy of bodies, but here the stakes, I think, are more explicit. In the course, they're more explicit. There's a recurrent discussion of the body of the worker and the body of wealth being co-constituted. And in this course, there's much more on the state than there is in Discipline and Punish, including some allusions to Althusser's work. But perhaps the most explicit development of themes in this course, as opposed to simply more detail on themes that are treated elsewhere, is of the treatment of popular insurrections and popular illegality. And the examples from England and France illustrate this here. He's interested in how both these movements are suppressed, but also how they're utilised by the dominant class. His key concept of popular illegality, which he says is a more useful term than simply the seditious mob, because these can be directed towards particular purposes by the dominant state. A certain popular illegality, he suggests, is not only compatible with, but useful for the development of the bourgeois economy. So he talks about different uses or tactics and says there's been a historical transition here. At one point, the bourgeoisie was trying to triumph over feudal structures, and it might use the working class as a strategic ally in that. But once in a position of power themselves, they become the new social enemy. You could look at that, for example, Foucault doesn't make this explicit, but you could look at that, for example, in England, with the mobilisation of popular unrest in the lead-up to the Great Reform Act of 1832. Once the bourgeoisie got a certain element of political power themselves, this wasn't an enfranchisement of everybody, but only a property classes in there, then the bourgeoisie effectively turn against the working classes, and the working classes then start trying to channel their dissent into the Chartist movement, which is suppressed by the bourgeoisie much more aggressively than it had ever been suppressed by the aristocracy in the past. So there's this kind of strategic ally for a particular purpose, and then the bourgeoisie might abandon them at that point. And he says that these shifts in how the bourgeoisie acts towards these workers parallels the move to imprisonment as the dominant penalty. The birth of industrial society is partnered by a gigantic operation which constitutes the penal and the penitentiary against popular illegality. Not simply in terms of the perceived threat to bourgeois wealth, but more and more resources previously held in common are becoming owned, they're becoming claimed by individuals. One example again, the forest, previously a place of refuge and survival, becomes exploitable property and thus surveyed or overseen, and that these techniques apply as much in the urban as in the rural and to the worker as much as the peasant. And different means can be used to address these concerns, through the use of the prison, through the use of the army for political purposes, through legal mechanisms or regimes, and through the labelling and work of the sciences, the kind of sciences of criminology, of psychopathology, and so on. Labelling of particular kinds of behaviour in negative ways, the emergence of the category of the delinquent as somebody who is savage, immoral, but perhaps reformable by surveillance and disciplinary techniques. Some of it is along the lines of straightforward class divisions. So he mentions Guy-Baptiste Tarjay's moralization of the two classes. One class is the bearer of virtues, the values of property. The other is characterized by vices, by immorality, such that it can be considered as a stranger to society, as a sort of exterior nation from the real nation, a division of society into two classes. So he says at the beginning of the 19th century, it's not just urbanization and new modes of production, but also a fear of the worker, of their desire, of their body, a fear of the working class. This fear has a foundation, he says, because bourgeois wealth is under threat from the working class and the limits of its poverty. But the working class increasingly becomes understood as a dangerous class. And he makes it very explicit. The bourgeoisie establishes the penal code to support property, providing a framework for the regulation of the body of the worker in relation to wealth, profit and law, not so much as a contract, but as a habit, as a disciplining. The capitalist regime is supported through law and war, through the penal system, with the direction of the criminal codes towards the social enemy, and through the use of the military force to directly protect the apparatus of production. Much of this is to do with the training of the body, to ensure that bodies are available for work, that the force of the body is channeled in the right direction for the necessary tasks within the economic system, but also that bodies are used for the reproduction of the forces of work, in other words, sexual reproduction, to have more children, to become the next generation of workers. And he talks about Alfonso Grün's moralization of the working classes from 1851 as a good example of this here. He makes some very interesting comments, I think, about the history of laziness. At this point, about kind of how a classical version of idleness or laziness gets transformed in the imagination of these people as a sort of a strategic refusal to work, and that's something that needs to be transformed through a whole range of mechanisms, but using the police is the broad understanding of the police as you get it in, say, somebody like Hegel or in Stuart or in Adam Smith, the kind of the idea of the police as a not simply an uniformed force to prevent and detect crime, but the police as the kind of policy or the putting into practice of different mechanisms within society here. And he talks about the way that you need to have mechanisms, these are familiar mechanisms from Foucault's other works, a graduated, continuous, cumulative system with the continuity and capillarization of justice into everyday life, general surveillance and the form of the examination, that crucial term in this course. And I'd suggest that if then the dominant example in Discipline and Punish is the army for understanding how we got to the point we did, in this course the key reference is the factory or the workshop. The figure of control is the boss in the factory or the foreman in the workshop. And he talks about a whole range of corrective institutions, agricultural colonies, reformatories, prisons, and therapeutic institutions of hospitals and asylums. And he says that there are the explicit instruments of prison, colony, army and police. The key thing, the construction and the protection from the social enemy and the moralisation of the working class. That seems to be very explicit in this course, not so much in Discipline and Punish. Okay, let me close by talking a little bit about two methodological issues, maybe 5 minutes or so. This course, I think, is useful. This is 1973. For tracking how Foucault's thinking is developing on two methodological issues, the understanding of power and the genealogical approach. Foucault here is continually stressing the relation between knowledge and power, and that's a familiar thing from Foucault's slightly later work, but in this course we begin to see it emerging in a kind of a mature form. Knowledge, power, he keeps stressing. The prison form is much more than an architectural form, it is a social form. We can map, he says, what images symbolise the form of power. We can go from the medieval throne, the place of listening and judging, the magistral or the majestic form of power, the head that commands the body or the frontispiece of Leviathan, the king's body towering over the society, but the body made up of the bodies of the individual people. The modern form, though, he says, might begin from a centre, but it's the way it spreads out in society along tendrils, kind of stretching from a singular point. And I mentioned the star form of the prison. I couldn't resist this, given that I actually wrote much of this talk in the State Library of Victoria, not far down the road. You have on the ground floor the centralised point, and you have those effectively a star form of those desks, so that somebody in that middle place can see everybody at all of the desks across the ground floor. But if you go above the ground floor, you have effectively a panoptic structure around there because of the shape of the room. And if you imagine a tower in the middle point instead of that desk, that you could survey somebody who's in all of those galleries that are around those instruments there. So you have the kind of spatial juxtaposition of these two things, the form that Foucault uses in this course and the form that he later uses in Discipline and Punish to as an architectural form to illustrate these kinds of questions. Okay, in this course, Foucault summarises, he's done this in some of the previous courses, but he's really starting to get to the familiar ways he summarises what his understanding of power is as opposed to previous ways people have understood the question of power. And he says there's four ways we've traditionally understood power that he wants to reject. One is the idea of the appropriation of power, or power as a property. He says certainly the formula which class has power is a politically useful formula, but it's not a very historically useful formula. Power, he says, is not possessed, it is exercised. Power is not monolithic, it's never stable, it's never known once and for all, but power is always mobile. Brings us to the second point. He wants to challenge the idea that power can be easily located. It's not strictly localized in state apparatus. It's not even sufficient, he says, to say state apparatus are the stake of a struggle, the interior or the exterior. That is, practically neither the control nor the destruction of the state apparatus will be sufficient to transform or make power disappear. Rather, the grounding of power is much deeper, and we need to understand the way that it spreads through society and is located in several points rather than flowing from some centralised location. The third one is the idea that power is subordinate to the mode of production in order simply to maintain or reproduce it. He says power is not simply a guarantee of the mode of production as that which allows the constituting of the mode of production, but power is one of the constitutive elements of the mode of production and functions at the very heart of it. So he says one of the things that is crucial about this is that we need to break from the idea that work is crucial to humans, and we simply need to make sure that they actually deliver on that. He says actually what's essential to humans is a much more dispersed sense of power from their bodies that we can find in pleasure, in festivals, in rest, in violence, in a whole range of things. And what's important is about channeling those into continual work for the benefit of the market. The fourth one is he wants to reject the idea of power as ideology. All points of the exercise of power, he says, are at the same time a sign of formation not of ideology, but of knowledge. And we need to understand the relation between knowledge and power and how they link. It's not a mode of identity that knowledge is power or power is knowledge, but it's the interplay between them, it's the continual relation between them that we need to understand. All knowledge permits the exercise of power, but it cannot be reduced to it. Administrative surveillance, he says, is a knowledge of management, a knowledge of the inquiry, a knowledge of police inquisition, a knowledge of the idea of the examination. So he's getting closer and closer to what we might call his mature form or view of power that we get explicitly in 1976 in the first volume, The History of Sexuality. But he's beginning to sketch that contrast that's familiar from many of his other lecture courses in other places between sovereign power and this type of power that here he hasn't quite decided on its exact name, but he calls at different points disciplinary power, punitive power, or the power of normalisation. So he says, in other words, the discourse which speaks of the king and his majesty disappears and gives way to the discourse of the master, the discourse of one who surveys, prescribes the norm, makes the division between the normal and abnormal, the deviant and the ill, assesses, judges, decides, the discourse of the schoolmaster, the judge, the doctor, the psychiatrist. Linked to the exercise of power, we therefore need to see the appearance of a discourse which overtakes the mythical discourse of the origins of power, which told periodically of the genealogy of the king and his ancestors, but we can find this in the normalising discourse, that of the human sciences. So he makes various contrasts between different forms of power, between the ceremonies of power in the 17th century and the social conscience in this new period of time. It's tied to a political economic frame. The apparatus of confinement fixes individuals within the new system directed towards political economic purposes. It says the apparatus of confinement fixes individuals within the apparatus of production. It fabricates the norm and produces the normal. And he comes up with a sequence, a series, which he says characterises modern society. Constitution of a labour force, apparatus of confinement, permanent function of normalisation. All of these familiar from Foucault's later work, but here starting to be developed in their explicit form, in their explicit language here. And then he brings the course pretty much to a conclusion, suggesting, in summary, it is a society which links the permanent activity of punishment, a connected activity of knowledge, of registration. Recall that we live in a punitive and examining society, a disciplinary society. And in Discipline and Punish, we need to remember that the original French title of that book is Surveiller et Punir, more literally, survey and punish, not discipline and punish. And that the pairing of those terms within this wider system of discipline first emerges in this text, it seems to me, within a much more broad and explicitly economic analysis. So he says the pair survey-punish is established as the indispensable power relation for the fixation of individuals within the apparatus of production, the constitution of productive forces, and characterises this society that we call disciplinary. There's also some interesting discussion of the relation between archaeology and genealogy here, and what I think is striking here, and this is clear from a number of other places in Foucault's course, even though the secondary literature doesn't seem to do this, it's not archaeology and then he does genealogy. It's archaeology is there and genealogy is developed to work alongside it, and that these two things need to be understood together in terms of what Foucault's doing around these questions. But here he's still playing with what the terminology might be. He relates the idea of genealogy to what he calls a dynastic analysis. He says, now it's a matter of retrieving what the relations of power which made possible the historical emergence of something like the prism. After an analysis of the archaeological type, it is a question of making analysis of the dynastic genealogical type, tracing the filiations starting from the relations of power. So he says the question is, why this strange institution that is the prism? Why did this become the key thing that we use for punishment in society? And that's a question that he says is not simply about the how it operates, but what were the purposes for it? Why did we use this, and why have we come to this as the effective final form of this? Now, in addition, Foucault takes his earlier notion of the idea of the episteme, the form of knowledge, the discursive formation of knowledge of a particular time, and he broadens this to begin to include practices rather than simply discourse. This is how he phrases it in this course. There are therefore two ensembles, the penal ensemble characterized by the prohibition and the sanction, the law, and the punitive ensemble characterized by the coercive penitentiary system. The first carries with it a certain theory of infraction as an act of hostility towards society. The second carries with it the practice of imprisonment. And he links the first explicitly to the state institutionalization of justice, which he says can be traced archaeologically to a practice of justice organized for the exercise of sovereign political power since the Middle Ages. The second comes from a movement of development, not of the state itself, but from the capitalist mode of production. In the second, we can see the mode of production give rise to the instruments of political power, but also a moral power. The question, though, is more than simply an archaeological one. Thus, the genealogical problem is, he says, one to know how these two ensembles of different origins come to be added together and function inside the same tactic. Now, what I think is striking about this is that the word that Foucault's using here, ensemble, is actually what he later comes to call the dispositif. Now, the dispositif is a term that emerges in some of the later lecture courses. It's there in Discipline and Punish, but not always entirely clear how he's stressing it, and then becomes absolutely crucial to the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, something that is completely obscured by the existing English translation, which translates it predominantly as deployment, which makes no sense whatever, but also occasionally as apparatus, mechanism, device, layout, and organisation. So it's very, very hard from the existing English translation to work out what Foucault's doing with this term, the dispositif, which Gilles Deleuze and Georges Agamben have picked up and done work with afterwards. But in this course, Foucault seems to be talking about it as the idea of the ensemble, in that it brings together not simply the discursive, but also the practices together, which is precisely what he's trying to do with the dispositif later. So, in summary then, why I think this is such an interesting course. It's part of that an opening three sequence of courses at the Collège de France, one that looked at the measure, one that looked at inquiry, and one that looked at examination. It develops themes of discipline, normalization, and punishment that will occupy Foucault for several more years, notably in Psychiatric Power and the Abnormals, the lecture courses, but also in Discipline and Punish. It opens up themes of civil war and the social enemy that come through in 1976, of course, Society Must Be Defended, but also in the lectures on governmentality. but its examples are broader than those texts because there's a large amount on English social and political history. Foucault's also been reading some of the historians, Marxist historians, often people like E.P. Thompson, who've written about that period of English social and political history. Perhaps most importantly, developing from that, I think the biggest revelation of this course is how all of these are read through a much more explicitly political, economic, even Marxist lens. Foucault comes in time to take issue with some of those political economic readings. So in the history of sexuality, for example, there's a critique of the Wilhelm Reich, Herbert Marcuse, a kind of political economic reading of why sexuality has been repressed at certain points. Foucault rejects that schema. But in this course, it seems to me that he's offering a complementary and corrective focus to a lot of those Marxist accounts rather than rejecting those overall. And finally, there's a number of elements in this course that are helpful in terms of the emergence of the way that he's thinking about power and genealogy. And in all that, I think we can read the course as much more than simply a first draft of Discipline and Punish.